Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Governor Mark Gordon is the latest guest on a show where the interview happens over a meal, and he finished his whole plate.
It said to me that this is someone who understands the biblical and political idea of breaking bread.
A silent trend is affecting Wyoming's economy, the steady decline of childcare providers. And some of the state's rules could be making it worse.
And then DFS was like, that's illegal. So I was like, wait, why?
Spanish-speaking communities are vital in many Mountain West towns, and so is their need to access services and express themselves at public events.
Like, you can speak in the language that you are born or the language of your heart.
That's coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Wyoming Public Radio now takes you around Wyoming. You'll hear about interesting stories and events from just down the street and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:04 and 4:50. You can also subscribe to our daily roundup newsletter at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming sounds, jazz Wyoming, and classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Moose, elk, and pronghorn roam the Kelly Parcel, a 640-acre tract sprinkled with sunflowers near Grand Teton National Park. It could be sold off by the state for development unless the national park raises millions to buy it, and if the federal government makes some compromises. Months after lawmakers passed the outline of the deal during the last legislative session, its future remains uncertain. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements takes us on a tour of the parcel.
Under a chrome-colored sky ribboned by rain clouds, local rancher Jake Hutton leads a horseback tour of the Kelly Parcel, telling stories all the while.
I got charged by a grizzly bear right here last spring.
She came barreling out of the trees and bluff charged for a second, stopped at 50 yards. Stood up and growled and then made up her mind and took off right after me again.
Hutton leads these tours as his business, giving tourists and myself a glimpse of the Wyoming landscape on horseback.
We come out of a grove of aspen and summit a nearby hill. We're looking at the Tetons as our horses snort.
Sagebrush, larkspur, and wild roses simmer under hoof in the humid late afternoon heat. But these tours could go away. Wyoming is constitutionally obligated to raise money for public schools from state lands like the Kelly Parcel, whether it be through managing them or selling them off. Due to its proximity to public lands, it's not easy for the state to make money off the parcel through management. That's a threat to the parcel, since it would be prized real estate for developers if it were ever put up for auction on the open market. Last year, the State Board of Land Commissioners made headlines when it proposed doing exactly that. Wyomingites across the state fervently opposed that idea, and in response to public outcry, the legislature passed a deal to conserve the Kelly Parcel by selling it to Teton National Park for $100 million. The sale has inspired strong opinions all around, including in Hutton.
$100 million is a lot of money, but also in the big world of politics and big budgets, $100 million is going to go away pretty quick, and they're never going to get it back.
The National Parks Nonprofit Foundation has 2 years to raise $38 million for the land transfer. The federal government will kick in the rest of the cash. Leslie Mattson is the foundation's president.
This is a heavy lift for us to raise $38 million basically from early winter until hopefully sometime during calendar 24 would be our hope.
It's the largest figure the foundation has ever had to raise, and in a remarkably short amount of time. And while Mattson says that she and the foundation are cautiously optimistic they'll find the funds in time, the nail biting isn't nearly over.
People say, well, congratulations, you got it done. I'm like, no, we didn't get it done yet.
In general, an obstacle to closing out the sale is a deep-seated distrust of the federal government in the cowboy state. Jared Becker is with the nonprofit Greater Yellowstone Coalition.
Over time, we have seen that land transfers between the state of Wyoming and the federal government have become more complicated.
Another wrinkle lies in the fine print that passed the legislature. Lawmakers added a line tying the fate of the deal to the Federal Bureau of Land Management. The BLM must choose a specific management plan for the Rock Springs area. If not, it could squash the purchase altogether. But if the BLM does what the legislature wants, the Kelly Parcel deal would go before the Board of Land Commissioners for a final vote of approval. But even there, another challenge is looming. A working group formed by the board is exploring a different variation of the deal.
I favor looking at an exchange with the federal government.
That's Megan Degenfelder, Wyoming's superintendent of public instruction and one of five members on the board.
We cannot allow the federal government to get a sweetheart deal on the backs of Wyoming students, which these state lands fund.
Her preference is for the state to buy or swap land owned by the feds in Wyoming that has oil and gas resources in exchange for the Kelly Parcel.
I think in fall of this year, we're going to see multiple options come before the board, and I hope that this is one of them.
Degenfelder says she'll vote against the legislature's straight-up sale if it ever winds up before the board. It would only take two more votes to kill it. Even if adding on another condition to the transfer makes the feds walk away entirely, Degenfelder says, in her opinion, it's a risk worth taking.
That's too bad. I mean, we have to do what's best for Wyoming. I will always, always do what's best for Wyoming rather than the federal government.
Of course, if neither iteration of the deal succeeds, the parcel could wind up right back where this all began, with the board putting it up for auction. Greater Yellowstone Coalition's Jared Becker says that if the parcel ended up in the hands of private developers, it would
absolutely fragment and hinder some of the greatest migrations of hoofed mammals in the lower 48 states.
He and others point to the unique geography of the parcel and the mountains surrounding it.
Physically, the landscape is a bottleneck. It's a choke point between two mountain ranges. It also serves as a migration path for mule deer in the sublet mule deer herd.
Back at the Kelly Parcel, the sun sets behind the Tetons, which jut up from the earth like the jawbone of some ancient beast. Jake Hutton stops the group to take a moment to look at the mountains.
I'm pretty convinced this is the best view in Wyoming from right here.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
Can we amuse our democracy back to life? Can we incentivize empathy and compromise instead of viciousness and dysfunction? These are the driving questions behind the TV series Breaking Bread with Alexander. Host Alexander Heffner invites governors and U.S. senators to dinner to talk about policy, democracy, and their backgrounds. And he recently dined with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon at the historic Occidental Hotel in Buffalo.
You know, all things in moderation. That could have been a title for this episode with Governor Gordon, all things in moderation, because the plate had potatoes, asparagus or broccoli, and the steak. And then we had strawberries in the pie. Very well-rounded meal. And we started with salad, as you'll remember, too. Mm-hmm.
The Caesar, yeah.
Exactly.
Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette recently caught up with Heffner to hear about the series and how Gordon stands out.
Alexander, can you tell me a bit about this series, Breaking Bread with Alexander? Why did you want to profile governors in this particular way? And what are you hoping to learn?
I've always thought of politics as not just the art of the possible, but the reality of the survivable and the pursuit of perfecting our union. And that's highfalutin, but when it comes down to brass tacks, the fact is politics determines our well-being, our livelihood. And that's the spirit I brought to the conversations with food and sustenance as the entry point that I think can incentivize a better way forward.
In the episode, you mentioned that Gordon ate his full plate, and that seems like a detail that really stuck out to you. What did that tell you about him?
It told me that breaking bread was not an abstract concept that was just imagined by me to him, and that somewhere along the line, his grandmother or another family member might have said, finish your plate, and equate finishing your plate with a respect for not only the chef and the family or the people with whom you're dining, but yourself in the dialogue in which you're engaged. But it said to me that this is someone who understands the biblical and political idea of breaking bread.
I want to tuck into some of the topics that you guys covered in your conversation. It was pretty far-reaching. You talked about cowboy culture, American energy renewal, the threat of white supremacy, overpopulation of grizzly bears, also what Gordon calls the radical center, economics, electoral politics, his work in the private sector. Among that whole list, what really stood out to you?
Well, you named some of the highlights. I think that on a personal level, his relationship with his dad, and I felt that the public ought to learn and would relate to an intergenerational difference of opinion about how to run your farm or ranch.
I just grew up knowing that I was supposed to do ranching and I was supposed to help my folks. So breaking away from that was really hard to do. And in time, I think he grew very respectful of what we'd done, but I grew so much more respectful.
I think also his unabashed acknowledgement of extremism and, you know, the fact that hate groups do exist and they're still a threat to the well-being of all Americans.
I think white supremacy is very much on the rise, and I'm very concerned about it. I don't condone violence against our country. I think it's a very great homeland security threat.
That was a meaningful statement in a state when a significant constituency of voters would disagree with him and not view white supremacy, bigotry, political violence as the threat that he identified. So, you know, those were a few areas that would make a viewer of this really think about representing the full body of America. You know, we've gotten caught up in the blue and red state, the conundrum, and all of our conversations revolve around unpacking gridlock and the idea of homogeneous, even authoritarian, blue or red control in a given state. One of the purposes of this series is to counter that narrative, which I think is fundamentally wrong. Every state in our union is purple. It's a medley of red and blue. It's shocking to me that we've accepted this as a citizenry when we know better. We know that this is often a tool deployed to exploit division and disharmony for the gain of extremes. I think we just forget that. And breaking bread is also designed to remind people of that.
Yeah, like breaking up this idea that voters are monoliths.
Right, breaking that idea. And if we thought of something as a red state, it would really mean that the glass was entirely full of one way of thinking about something. Likewise, if it was a blue state, none of these states really is blue or red. And so that's my basic proposition, that if you have a Republican supermajority legislature and a Republican governor, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a diversity or pluralism of thought.
I'm curious about the similarities and differences among the governors and senators that you've spoken to, and kind of where Gordon fits into that mix. You know, where does he zig, where you see others zagging, and where does he align in the priorities, both policy, but also just kind of how we govern ourselves?
So he was the only one who zigged in finishing his plate. He was also the only one who zigged in authoring a handwritten thank you letter.
Oh, wow.
That's something that once again emphasized an understanding of the way discourse used to be and is not in great preponderance now. It's just not practiced this way. So for me, those are constitutional level zigs. Another difference with Governor Gordon, like Governor Polis of Colorado, Governor Cox of Utah, and most recently Governor Lujan Grisham, not surprising, all four are in Breaking Bread, either season one or season two. They have been the most visible ambassadors of the National Governors Association Disagree Better campaign, and I applaud them, but it's not enough. Disagreeing better doesn't save a union or sustain a republic. I think they all know that, and they're trying to take baby steps, whatever is possible, in a climate that incentivizes the division. Even within this series of conversations, it wasn't always as visible that each one of these governors and senators wants to change, wants to reverse the viciousness in our politics right now. And it was visible with him.
Well, Alexander, this has been fascinating. Tell me, where can we find your series, Breaking Bread with Alexander?
You can find it on Bloomberg Originals and The Open Mind on PBS. You can stream it digitally.
Excellent. Alexander Hefner, thank you so much for making time to talk about what you learned during your interview with Governor Mark Gordon.
Thank you.
In the last decade, hundreds of daycares have shut down in Wyoming. We learn how one community is trying to create a solution. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Corb Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney in the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Back in 2010, Wyoming still had 855 licensed daycare centers, but in the last 14 years, a third of those have shut down. Meanwhile, the need for childcare is high. This March, the town of Dubois, population 931, lost its only daycare. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, some local parents are now racing to find a solution.
Not long ago, Tiny Tots Daycare was a hubbub of children's voices, infants all the way up to 5 years old. Jess Unger ran the center for 5 years and did her best to shuffle around 21 kids so their parents could work. She also had a long wait list, but couldn't afford the staff or rent to grow the school. So Unger realized she had to put an end to all that hubbub.
There's just no feasible way that, in Wyoming at least, in these smaller areas, that you'll ever have enough enrollment to make it work. I racked my brain for a long time.
The tipping point came when the school district opened a pre-kindergarten and Unger's whole class of older kids left. If she wanted to take on more younger kids, she'd need more teachers to adhere to guidelines. And that meant less income to keep the daycare alive. But Unger also just felt exhausted.
You're sick a lot. because, well, kids, just germs. I've been thrown up on. I've been used as a toilet. I've had other people's child snot in my mouth.
And she couldn't pay herself enough to make it worth it. After she closed, Du Bois had zero licensed childcare. The closest was Lander or Jackson. Casey Sedlak's two boys were both forced to stay home. Sedlak runs a consulting business, plus helps run a ranch. Right away, her family went into emergency mode. Now Sedlak does whatever she has to do to keep them busy. Today, she's got them doing chores. 7-year-old Levi waters the flowers. 5-year-old Charlie takes care of the chickens. But 3-year-old Tilly says no chores for her.
I was supposed to do dog poop, but I hate dog poop.
But still, it isn't easy getting the kids settled down so that their mom can chat.
2020. Sorry. Hey. That's not okay. There's no hitting. Just help out. Just.
Since then, it's been hard to get her work done. A recent study on the childcare crisis in rural America shows that about 10,000 Wyomingites aren't able to work because of a lack of childcare. Sedlak asked other families about a nanny share.
The answer was, that's great. And then DFS is like, that's illegal. So I was like, wait, why? Why is that illegal?
One of the barriers to solving the childcare crisis is the number of regulations the Department of Family Services has about who's allowed to care for kids and how many. Wyoming currently says a nanny can only care for 2 unrelated children at a time. Sedlak was so perplexed by this, she testified to lawmakers at a committee meeting. It worked. Now they're drafting a bill to allow a nanny to care for up to 5 families. But Micah Richardson with the Wyoming Women's Foundation says, sure, it needs to be easier to get childcare. But lawmakers shouldn't throw out too many rules, like child caregiver ratios.
We have also heard from providers who are like, I don't want to have one person watching 20 kids like that. That is not helpful. That is stressful.
Potentially worsening caregiver burnout. What she really wants to see is some state funding to help parents afford care and to pay caregivers better. It's worth the money, she says. Since the childcare crisis, it's really a labor problem.
It just becomes a larger economic issue of having the support we need and the people available to do the jobs in Wyoming.
That's why parent Sarah Domek and other Du Bois parents plan to reopen Tiny Tots under a new name, Little Lambs. They've applied for grants and are hosting fundraisers to raise the money. Inside, piles of toys and infant beds wait for a caregiver to put it all in order.
We've got the bathrooms and 2 rooms that can be used for napping, for nap time.
They also plan to use a new business model they hope will be less impacted by low child enrollment and staff turnover. Little Lambs will be a nonprofit daycare.
And it seemed to be the most sustainable model because you could tap into other granting sources, and that's what we want. We want sustainability.
For months, they've been trying to hire people to fill positions. Recently, they had a couple solid interviews. For Domek, it's urgent that this new daycare gets up and running. She works full-time for a conservation group and will desperately need childcare in a few months. She's expecting a baby any minute. Otherwise,
well, do we move to Pinedale for a few years and closer to my folks and they could help?
As for parent Casey Sedlak, she's optimistic that Wyoming can find a way.
When you live in a community that's this rural, you've got to get creative and you've got to say like, okay, we've had to think outside the box to live here. How do we think outside the box to keep living here?
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
As communities in the Mountain West grow, so does the need for Spanish language interpreters. This is especially true in booming resort towns like Jackson Hole, where Latinos power economies and also need to access services. As Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports, some people are stepping up to fill that language gap.
Celia Perez has kind of been interpreting between English and Spanish since elementary school.
I didn't really realize like the difference in languages at home and school.
Sitting on a brown suede couch in her Victor, Idaho apartment, Perez says she moved to the region in the Tetons back in the 90s. She was part of a generation born in Mexico, but raised in the U.S.
I spoke both languages and my mom like understood me. I grew up a little more and I noticed like she needed help at the store or my dad needed help, you know, with asking for something.
Now Perez has 5 kids of her own, all boys. And this language skill has grown into a full-blown career. She's been trained in community and medical interpreting and is starting her own business, Teton Language Services. She says it's especially needed since local nonprofits estimate the region's population to be about 30% Latino.
If I have the capacity to help somebody, then why not?
Across the Tetons in Jackson, Wyoming, Giovanna Carrillo Contreras says the industry has become a lot more professional as more people pick up the craft. She's based near Denver, but has spent her career traveling around the country, training people on all kinds of interpreting, including groups in Jackson.
So it's not only listening, it's active listening.
Carrillo Contreras paces around a conference room on the first day of a week-long training. She's speaking to 12 bilingual health workers, police officers, and airline and hotel staffers, and says what they've been doing so far is simply repeating what someone has said. But that's not enough.
There is a lot of cognitive processes that happen at the brain level before we are able to do it. And those that are able to...
Meaning, understand regional dialects and not just say what someone said, but how they said it. These are things that Google Translate or someone who's bilingual and hasn't had any training might miss. Before breaking for lunch, Carrillo Contreras makes a sales pitch for the profession.
Give me your week this week and start laying the foundations. Questions, comments, take up.
With more people taking trainings like these, interpreting businesses have popped up everywhere from Salt Lake City to Santa Fe. Over on Colorado's western slope, Antonio Rodriguez has been interpreting for local governments and nonprofits in the Telluride area for about 6 years. For him, interpreting is all about language justice.
Like, you can speak in the language that you are born or the language of your heart.
Rodriguez says for immigrants like him, it can be hard to express your thoughts in government meetings and other public settings. Interpreting helps, but he says local officials also need to do more outreach to Latino communities.
They think because there is going to be an interpreter, all the work is done. And I'm like, no, you really need to make that connection.
Back in the Tetons, Blanca Moye has been doing that outreach with social service organizations for over 20 years.
Always is someone looking for help, and I always raise my hand.
Sitting in the lobby of the public library, she says in the 90s, that included interpreting for police when they pulled over Spanish speakers. She's now the bilingual coordinator for an affordable housing nonprofit and says the need for interpreters is ever present with people moving here all the time for work and a way of life, even for the longtime residents.
And they still need help, you know, because they used to spend the time working.
But even with more formal processes and interpreters stepping up to help, Moye still sees gaps at a lot of private companies and organizations. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
Coming up, the road to Cheyenne. Stick with us as we learn about races to keep an eye out in the northeast corner of the state. This is Open Spaces.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kodalska. And now to The Road to Cheyenne, our special series previewing the primary elections. This week, we're previewing state legislative races in the northeast corner of the state. And we'll take a deeper look at the Republicans challenging U.S. Senator John Barrasso in the primary. So to help me understand all of this, Wyoming Public Media Northeast reporter Jordan Uplinger and state government reporter David Dudley are joining me. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Great. So when we talk about the northeast corner of the state, we're looking at Sheridan, Buffalo, Gillette, and east to the border all the way down to Casper. Jordan, we sent you out to hear from voters in Casper. What stood out to you in Casper?
So I talked with a couple of different people, young, old, some business owners, people who were visiting downtown from the surrounding suburbs. The majority of people intended to do their research or had an issue that they cared about, but few were actively following these Senate races. Here's three individuals from Casper. First, we hear Jacob Paulo, followed by Lee Dermis, and then Liz Davis.
I don't really pay attention to, like, the local ones. I don't know why, but I probably really should.
I have not been following the local races. I know that there's one on school board that looks pretty contentious, and I'm going to be reading up on it.
I haven't followed it as closely as I have in the past just because I'm very busy. However, I don't think that we have enough young candidates, and I don't think that the majority of the candidates that are on the ballot this year are educated on the actual issues facing the working class in Wyoming.
Interesting. Well, you've been following two Senate races locally in this area, so can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm watching Senate District 22 and 30, where primary challengers might decide that unofficial alignment of moderate Wyoming caucus Republicans and far-right Freedom Caucus Republicans in the Senate.
So it seems to be a common theme of this election cycle. And just to note, the Freedom Caucus is only a thing in the House, but senators align with their policy priorities and sometimes work in tandem on legislation. So let's start with Senate District 22, which covers Sheridan down through Buffalo and into Casey.
Yeah, so this is a major energy producing area, a lot of mines and a slowly but steadily growing population. Dave Kinsey is not running for re-election. He was mayor of Cheyenne. During the last session, he was Senate vice president, and eventually he was stripped of his Appropriations Committee chair by Senate President Ogden Driscoll. Now we have Barry Crego running against Mark Jennings, both of whom currently serve in the House but are running for this open Senate seat. Jennings is also a founding member of the Freedom Caucus as well.
So since we know this seat will end up with a Republican, the question for the people living in this district, District 22, is, you know, what kind of Republican? Can you go into a little more detail on that?
Right. What kind of Republican? So Crego laid out the right-wing moderates' priorities in a 2023 op-ed to Cowboy State Daily. They included property tax reform and relief, educational savings accounts, suicide prevention, parental rights, reducing electricity costs. These goals aren't too far off, ideologically speaking, from Jennings. Jennings also has his sights set on tax reform. He's an advocate for all-encompassing parental rights when it comes to education. What separates Jennings from Crego is that Jennings is focused far more heavily on hardline, culturally conservative positions. For example, Jennings criticized Crego for voting to legalize marijuana, although that bill ultimately did not pass. Jennings also attacked Crego for adding amendments that weakened and delayed the Life is a Human Right Act, a bill that would ban most forms of abortion. Crego talks about his work to open a new veterans home, and he supports members in the House and Senate voting their conscience. So really, it will come down to voters researching the candidate or just going off name recognition.
Okay, thanks. And let's move over to Senate District 30. This district covers the west half of Casper, part of the Casper Mountains, and some of the Powder River.
Yeah, so this area is governed by Senator Charles Scott, who's held the seat since 1983. The rancher is trying to keep his seat. He's had a hand in a lot of bills over this length of time, but in recent memory, his big focus has been on education. He supported a Senate file to allow charter schools to apply for state loans. He sponsored a bill to separate teacher pay from education block funding so that the pay can't be used elsewhere. His opponents offer two competing economic visions of Wyoming, however. Robert Hendry is an ex-Natrona County commissioner, and one of his priorities is emergency pregnancy services and hospitals' ability to generate a profit. He says that Wyoming is economically in a good position. Charles Schoenwolf says otherwise. He says that the current economic state of Wyoming is the fault of temporary tax increases that become permanent. Charles Schoenwolf has been running a home care agency for about 6 years. He also has an endorsement from the Wyoming Education Association and is a strong proponent of guns and Second Amendment rights. As far as who's center-right and far-right, in comparison to Scott, it's just hard to make that call. We're unsure of their specifics on abortions or parental rights right now. Scott is also 78 years old, and he's unsure for how many more elections he wants to run. He's still the incumbent, so the primary favors him, but his opponents don't have decades of voting to find error in. They're much more focused in their messaging.
All right. Well, thanks, Jordan. Thanks for that insight on the northeast section of the state. So turning to you, David, we're focusing on the Wyoming U.S. Senate seat, and up for re-election this year is Senator John Barrasso. Wyoming's second senator, Cynthia Lummis, is not up for election this time. But David, Barrasso has some competition. Who are they?
Yeah. So first, there's Reed Rasner, a financial advisor who lives in Casper. Then there's John Holtz, who ran against Barrasso in 2018 and was trounced by more than 70,000 votes in the primary.
Wow. Okay. So Barrasso has been in the U.S. Senate since 2007. He's currently the third-ranking GOP in the Senate. Does he seem worried about this competition?
Unfortunately, I can't answer that. I've reached out to his team on multiple occasions, and they haven't given me a chance to interview him yet. But he visited Cody for the 4th of July, and he was in Cheyenne about a week ago for the groundbreaking of the new Meta data center being built south of town. I'd say he doesn't seem to be worried, but he recently withdrew from a debate on PBS. I'm still trying to make sense of that move. But in his video announcing his run, he said that the border is a problem. He'd like to get the federal government out of Wyoming, and he would also like to get inflation under control.
Okay, so let's learn a little bit more about the two Republicans running against him. So let's start with Reed Rasner.
So Rasner told me that he's running to work on behalf of military veterans and energy workers whose livelihoods may be impacted by federal calls to cut back fossil fuel production. Those are two significant voter groups in Wyoming. When we spoke, he referred to former President Trump as, quote, President Trump in the present tense. He identifies strongly with former President Trump's approach, but Barrasso touts a Trump endorsement, so it'll be interesting to see which one of them wins those votes.
Okay, so Rasner might be gaining some steam, but there's another Republican running against him, so John Holtz. Who's he?
Holtz says he's the only military veteran in this race. He was a space systems operations officer in the Air Force. He's also a former judge. Holtz said that he gave that up because he has, quote, a big mouth and strong opinions, end quote. One of his opinions, which seems to be more popular amongst voters, is that he's tired of the infighting amongst Republicans, as well as their inability to work with people across the aisle to find common sense solutions. He says that he's concerned about property taxes and energy. He wants to make sure that taxes remain affordable and that Wyoming can keep the lights on.
So to put this race into some perspective, last time Barrasso was up for re-election, he had way more competition. He had five Republican opponents in the primary of 2018, but he still won no problem. So do we actually think these two Republican opponents have a chance in this primary?
If the election of 2018 offers any clues, Barrasso appears to be on firm ground. He won about 65% of the votes in the primary and then 67% of the votes in the general election. I've heard people use terms like untouchable to describe Barrasso's position in the Republican Party, but I also saw a number of angry voters approach his table at this year's Republican convention. They told his staffer that they would no longer vote for him. It occurred to me then, as if this year's budget session wasn't enough, that there's this hyper in-party partisanship within Wyoming politics. I saw something similar in Utah, which is also a deep red state. The term RINO, Republican in name only, has been used more lately by Republicans who feel that people within their own party aren't Republican enough, or that they're too willing to work with others who have conflicting perspectives. But the term goes back to Teddy Roosevelt Jr.'s presidency from 1901 to 1908. A Republican, Roosevelt was William McKinley's vice president. Roosevelt became president after McKinley was assassinated. Roosevelt was called a Republican in name only by his critics. He would go on to found the Progressive Party when he ran for president in 1912. Barrasso seems to be popular on the national stage. Between 2019 and 2024, he raised just over $306,000 in Wyoming and over $3.8 million out of state, according to OpenSecrets.org. To that point, I did talk to Dennis, who declined to give me his last name, of Gillette. He says he doesn't like those national priorities coming into Wyoming.
I believe that conservative spending and fiscal accountability is important, and that leadership should be based on not what Washington gives us, because I don't believe in Washington's value, Washington, D.C.'s values.
Okay, so I guess this is something that only time will tell. And just quickly, this is the primary, but Barrasso does have a Democratic challenger. Who is it?
That would be Scott Morrow, a retiree who lives in Laramie. Morrow was a union officer in the American Postal Workers Union, and he was their president from 1991 to 1995. Today, he's the president of their chapter of retirees, which is based in Denver. He says that he's laser-focused on the issues faced by retirees and senior citizens. His platform was inspired by Matthew 25 from the Bible, which he paraphrased as, "Treat the least among you as you would treat your God." He doesn't have a challenger in the primary, so he's waiting for the general election. Morrow says that if elected, he'll be a one-term senator because he doesn't agree with the idea of career politicians.
All right. Well, thank you, David, for enlightening us on this Senate race. And that's a wrap for this edition of The Road to Cheyenne. Thanks for being here with me, David and Jordan. And to our listeners, if you have any questions about voting, the electoral process, specific races, or candidates, feel free to give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 307-766-4314. We may use your voicemail on the show. Or go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and scroll down to our America Amplified banner to fill out a form to ask questions. The Road to Cheyenne will be back on the next Open Spaces, July 19th. We will be looking at the southwest part of the state in focus. You can also find this series online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. As fire season gears up, we meet an all-women's fire crew in Colorado. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, a homeless shelter in Cheyenne is trying to turn what former business into affordable housing units? Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Hi, Daryl Brogdon here, host of the Retro Cocktail Hour, inviting you to join me for the music that's always served up shaken, not stirred. Whether it's TV crime jazz or tiki tunes, space age bachelor pad music, swinging soundtracks, or other incredibly strange music, it's on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. As fire season gets underway, agencies are working hard to recruit wildland firefighters. Many say it's rewarding work, but it's a male-dominated career. One program in our region is looking to change that. Aspen Public Radio's Caroline Yanez reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
It's a cloudless morning in the Crystal River Valley.
and Rachel Seil is getting ready to start her workday, unpacking her chainsaw and other tools next to an impressive pile of branches and brush.
I was working an office job before this, and I quickly found out that I hate office jobs.
Instead of being stuck in an office, she's hiking through rugged terrain, creating fire breaks, and keeping neighborhoods safe from natural disasters. She's an assistant lead on a crew of wildland firefighters, one made up entirely of women. This developmental crew is the result of a partnership between the Western Colorado Conservation Corps, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service, designed to get more women into wildland fire jobs. The Forest Service estimates that up to 87% of its wildland firefighters are men. Lathan Johnson is an assistant fire manager with the BLM. He says the program has a dual benefit. Federal agencies get important fuels reduction work done before the height of fire season, and their workforce starts to look a little more like society as a whole.
Whether it's on a wildfire, whether it's on something we're doing here in the office, having that diversity in gender, I think, has always made a better team.
He says that when the program is over, all of the women will be certified to fight wildfires for federal agencies and will have completed all the training they need to get in the field. For the past several weeks, this crew has been clearing gamble oak and other plants from the ridge behind the Red Dog subdivision, tucked in the shadow of Mount Sopris. They gather the vegetation into large piles, which will be burnt later this year. Seil explains the fire prevention strategy behind the team's work.
Because when you have fresh vegetation or fresh soil, basically if there's any fire that's going on or anything like that, it's a lot harder for that fire to jump that because it's not like dry, it's not leafy, it's not anything like that.
But it has other benefits beyond reducing the risk of wildfire in a residential area. It helps to maintain wildlife corridors on the hillside, and it makes the remaining plants healthier. Ellie Zaire is helping Seil clear some of the vegetation uphill of the burn pile. She says when they're not in the field, they're getting mentorship, help with their resumes, and advice on what seasonal jobs they should apply for.
They're all so supportive, and they want more women in fire, and they're so happy that we have this program, and they each keep showing us what we should pack and what we should expect, and I just appreciate that so much because not everybody is willing to do that.
Yeah. The burn pile has already gotten a lot bigger in the hour or so the team has been working here, with one of them coming to crunch it down with her full weight every so often. It's difficult work that requires no small amount of physical fitness. The women work long days carrying heavy loads, sometimes even creating their own trails, and they often camp near their job sites instead of getting to sleep in beds. Ava Heller, another assistant crew lead, says that it's rewarding to see the results of their labor.
And I feel like I'm actually making a difference out here and doing something meaningful, which is so awesome. And that's probably my favorite part of the job, apart from working with all these wonderful people.
Estimates from the Western Colorado Conservation Corps, as well as the BLM and Forest Service, indicate that about 80% of the women who participated in the program in years past go on to have jobs in fire for at least the next season, and many go on to have careers in natural resources. And, in their feedback, they often attribute part of their success to getting the opportunity to learn the job in a welcoming environment. It's something Rachel Seil is grateful for.
Using all of these bigger tools and all this machinery and stuff like that, and not feeling judged and not feeling like you're inferior, it's very, very nice to feel actually supported and cared for.
For Aspen Public Radio News, I'm Caroline Yanez.
Current estimates suggest more than 70,000 wild horses roam the American West. That's more than three times the number land managers say can safely coexist with other animals on the open range. In recent years, the Federal Bureau of Land Management has stepped up efforts to move most of those animals off public land. But where do those horses go? And why are advocates concerned that these iconic symbols of the American West are still being slaughtered? Nevada Public Radio's Paul Boger reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
It's a crystal clear spring day in Paradise Valley, about half an hour north of Winnemucca, as the Bureau of Land Management's John Neal prepares to lead a tour through the state's newest wild horse holding facility.
Alrighty, Grant, take us away.
Neal is the acting facility operations manager for the BLM's Nevada Wild Horse and Burro program. He's technically in charge of caring for the wild horses rounded up on federal lands throughout the state. The animals brought here are treated for health conditions, vaccinated, and branded. According to Neal, at least 3,000 horses are corralled here. Most of them were rounded up earlier this year from the East Pershing Management Area west of Winnemucca. However, a few hundred remain from previous roundups. And since it's foaling season, Neal doesn't know the exact number.
There's well over 200 that have been born here so far this year, and more to come.
Horses are separated into pens according to their sex and age. Neal explains the horses have access to feed and running water, and that BLM has a vet on staff. What's noticeable is the lack of shade or sprinklers, and while the corrals appear relatively clean, they seem a bit crowded, maybe 50 to 60 horses in each pen. Advocates who are on the tour, including Laura Lee, the founder of Nevada-based Wild Horse Education, say the conditions of the corral were abysmal.
You were here on a sanitized day. This is probably the best this facility looks at any time. So, no shade, no dust control. This is built in a floodplain, so if we were here 2 weeks ago, you would have seen a whole different set of problems.
The horses here are destined for sale, a BLM pasture facility, or adoption. It's that last one that has other wild horse advocates concerned. In 2019, BLM began offering cash incentives to increase adoption rates. Adopters get $1,000 a year after each adoption, for up to four animals. In the first year, adoptions nearly doubled. Jenny Luciette is a public affairs specialist for the BLM's Nevada Wild Horse Program. She says many people like her love working with wild horses.
Best horse I've got when I'm pulling cows off the range is a wild horse. You know, we've got agencies that are utilizing them in their work because compared to a domestic horse, they're built much differently.
Advocates, on the other hand, say the process has become a pipeline to the slaughterhouse. Amelia Perrin is a spokesperson for American Wild Horse Conservation.
What people are doing is they're adopting the max amount of horses and burros that they can per year. They're holding them for 1 year in lands that you don't really have to take care of them. You don't really have to feed them. You can just turn them out into pasture and let them live. And then they're sending them into slaughter auctions.
Federal law currently prohibits the sale of wild horses for commercial use. BLM also requires people who want to adopt to sign paperwork saying they won't resell for a commercial purpose. Perrin says BLM could avoid potential slaughters altogether by focusing more on fertility control measures.
They need to start managing wild horses in the wild, stopping the influx, and then incentivizing responsible adoptions on the other end.
A bill currently before Congress would cut the time it takes to receive the full title of an adopted horse from 1 year to 6 months. It would also increase cash incentives from $1,000 to $3,000 and create a frequent adopter program. Lastly, the bill would make it a felony to sell wild horses for slaughter. Advocates have reservations regarding the measure, but for the BLM's Jenny Luciette, the legislation is a sign that more people are paying attention to wild horses. She's hopeful that means more of the animals will find a new home.
That's always going to continue to be my hope, is that, you know, every animal, I don't care if it's brown or if it's the beautiful paint horse on the internet, they all deserve a good home.
The next round of BLM horse adoptions in Nevada is June 15th. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Paul Boger in Reno.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, today's audio producer, and Nikki Roulette, our digital and social media producer today. And thank you to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.